Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad you're along today as we spend the next hour talking with you about how computer games help children learn. In fact, that's the title of the book written by David Williamson Schaefer. It's a great book. I had a chance to read it. You know, as you know or may know, I was on vacation for a couple of weeks in Florida, where I think it was 79 degrees the day we left. A little different here in Wisconsin, but as part of that vacation, I had some chances to read, and I had a chance to read David's book, and it was a very fascinating book. How can we make sure that our children are learning to be creative thinkers in this world of global competition? And what does it mean for our future of education in this digital age that we're in right now? You may have, at one time or another, worried about whether or not your own children were spending too much time on computer games. Are they destroying the minds of our nation's children? I think was a question that somebody posed once. David Schaefer doesn't think so, and he's got some wonderful ideas and thoughts to share with you and with me today, and I'm glad to have him along. And certainly, if you have questions as we move along today, you're most welcome to join in. If you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Anywhere else, it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. 1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And David, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You have you pose a question about how we're educating our children, and we may not be educating them in the proper ways for this digital age.
Well, I think almost certainly we're not. You know, the thing that we tend to think that schools as we know them are the natural and obvious way to educate kids, but they're not necessarily. Schools were invented 150 years ago, deliberately created to prepare people for life in an industrial economy. And we don't have an industrial economy anymore. So the basic facts and basic skills for standardized tests are a great way to prepare for standardized work, the kind of work that you have in a factory economy. In a knowledge economy, in the age of global competition, anything that can be standardized can be done somewhere else by somebody a mouse click away for a lot less money. The kinds of things that people need to get good jobs and to live satisfying and fulfilling lives in the economy that we have today, are they need to be able to think in innovative and creative ways about problems that matter. And that's what our schools aren't yet preparing to do. And that's what games can help us get our kids ready to do in their adult mm-hmm. lives.
I know you commented on the standardized tests. And one of the things you said in your book was that sometimes students are excellent at answering the questions, but then applying those answers, they're not so good at.
Right. And in fact, there's been a lot of research over the last 3 or 4 or 5 decades that shows exactly that. I mean, it's not that surprising. You know, kids are pretty smart. And if they recognize that the game of school is to learn to pass these tests, then that's what they focus their energy on. It's what you or I would do if we were faced with that. And so what we need to do is change that game. We need to make the game of school look more like the world that kids are going to go into, and the games that they play outside of school actually look more like that world than the games they play in school.
Mm-hmm. Talk about then explain for our listeners how the games and the things that you talk about actually can apply to real education.
Sure. So the thing to remember is that what a computer does is lets you build a simulation of the world. It can be a simulation of the real world or a simulation of a world that you imagine. And what a game does is lets people play in those simulated worlds. So you can play in worlds of adventure and worlds of excitement. Sometimes the games are about worlds of violence. But you can also create games that are about learning to be innovative and creative thinkers. Let me just give you one example it's in the book, and they're also described on our companion website, howcomputergameshelpchildrenlearn.com. So the game Urban Science, for example, is a game where players redesign a city. They actually redesign their own city. When we play it with kids here in Madison, they redesign State Street. And along the way, they have to learn about what different people in the community care about. They actually have an opportunity to interview them and give them questions as a focus group, get their feedback, and then try and redesign the street in a way that will satisfy the multiple and conflicting needs. So they have to learn about the difference between housing and retail and green space and what the impacts of those things are on jobs and the revenue for the city and crime and trash and waste and transportation and so forth. And so when you play this game, you don't just become better at playing the game. Our research shows that you actually get better at solving the kinds of problems that matter in the world. Mm-hmm. But there's no pat answer for that to win that game. You actually have to think about the problem in some way that nobody's quite thought of before, because there are lots of different ways to try and solve the problem. No solution is perfect. That's mm-hmm. the way things are in the world. Yeah. But some solutions are certainly better than others. Mm.
I should mention, by the way, that David Schaefer is also an associate professor of learning science at the UW-Madison and game scientist at the Academic Advanced Distributed Learning Co-Laboratory, as well as being author of How Computer Games Help Children Learn. And I should have mentioned that right away in the beginning. Certainly, again, if you want to join in, the number 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. And people have been waiting a while here, and I want to go to the phones, but just maybe one more question. And that relates to most games are not – most of the games I've ever played are games that where you learn just to get better at beating something without really thinking much about all of these alternatives that you're discussing. So not all games are great games necessarily.
Of course not. Just as not all books are great books, and even some books that are great books aren't great books for kids. What's exciting is that we can actually build games that are good games for kids and good games for learning. And the book is about how we can do that, why it matters, and actually also how you could look at a game that you might pick up off the shelf and figure out for yourself whether or not that was a game that was something that was going to be good for your kids.
Yeah, you have some great tips in there, and I certainly want to cover them before we're finished today. But I want to give Boyd in Milwaukee a chance. He's already been waiting a long time. Boyd, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Thank you, Larry, and welcome back. And hello, David. Wonderful topic. Just want to make a quick comment and a question. I thoroughly agree. I mean, for me, when I look at video games in this day and age, to me, they've certainly become part of the entertainment media. When you look at, like, in the past 10 years, how not only are a lot of video games based off of movies, but you've seen movies based off of video games. And I do game from time to time. I do have two nephews and a niece, and they love video games. And what I want to try and do is, I mean, I confess sometimes I've played like Duke Nukem and stuff like that, but I wouldn't certainly want them to play that. But I have seen games like that one based off of Batman and Robin, but it caters toward kids where it helps enhance their mathematical skills. And I think that's really, really good. And when you mentioned before about a game that takes place, you said you had one for Madison. It reminded me of a game called Civilization, which was excellent for learning. It might be a little bit sophisticated for children, but my question is this. How would I try and steer my nephews and niece into games like that where I feel they can still have their cake and eat it?
Right. That's a great question. Civilization is actually one of the games that I talk about in the book, at least briefly. The one of the best pieces of advice I can give to adults in terms of getting kids to play good games and to play games well is to play with them. It's the same sort of thing that we tell adults about books. We start reading to kids from a very young age. In fact, every piece of advice seems to be that almost as soon as your kid is born, put them on your lap and start reading books, Good Night Moon and those kinds of things. And it's because they actually come to understand what reading is about, that it's something enjoyable, that it's something that we value, how to focus and pay attention and so forth. And so there are lots of skills about using a computer and playing games well that you can transmit to your nephews or to your kids or to your grandkids by playing with them. Not only that, you'll actually learn a lot along the way if you don't play games. And if you do, you have a lot to teach them about how to play the games well. So that certainly might be a good start.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks a lot for calling, Boyd. Appreciate it. And we'll go to Mark and Racine next. Mark, hi to you.
Hi. How are you doing this morning?
Great.
I want to tell you a little story about my son. I got him his first computer when he was about 3 years old. And that kind of blended into Nintendo games and so forth. And this is 22 years ago. And today, my son has graduated from MSOE, he's a computer engineer, gainfully employed in Wisconsin, I might add. And we have probably $10,000 worth of used and old equipment in the basement. It will never be used because it's so old. But I think, I knew years and years ago, 21 years ago, 22 years ago to be exact, that computers were just the wave of the future. And if you aren't involved, or if you are at least computer literate, you're just going to go nowhere. And I made sure that my son was not only computer literate, but his physics grades, his music grades, just everything pointed in that direction. And it's just been a wonderful trip, not only for me, but for my son, too.
I thank you very much for calling, Mark and David. Comment from you?
Sure. Well, first of all, it sounds like you have the opportunity to start a great computer museum. Of it's wonderful to look back and see what seemed like it was cutting edge 20 and 30 years ago. In fact, when the original Palm Pilots came out, which now seem like they're a dinosaur of a technology, they had more computing power than the rocket that sent the Saturn V rockets that sent the astronauts to the moon. So it's really interesting how far we've come in 20 or 30 years. But you're absolutely right. As these technologies become more powerful, they touch every aspect of our lives. And becoming literate in digitally literate is important in the same way as being literate with print and with books is. And the same things apply. You know, if you learn to read as an adult, you never quite read in the same way as if you learn early on. If you learn a language as an adult, you never quite learn the language in the same way. The same thing is true for computers. It's a particular way of thinking, and the earlier you can get your kids started, the better off they're going to be.
Thanks again for calling, Mark. And Mark mentioned music and mentioned physics, and I know you have some wonderful examples of how children in the studies that you've participated in or know about and have written about were able to learn a lot about physics, for example, without ever having taken a course in physics.
Yeah. Well, and you know what happens in these games is you create, as I mentioned earlier, you create a virtual world, and those virtual worlds operate by rules just as our world does. They could be real, the rules of real physics. They could be rules of some kind of imaginary world as well. But when you try and get something done in one of these virtual worlds, you bump up against the same kinds of challenges that you bump up against in the real world. And if the world is a simulation of the way physics works, in order to try and do something in that world, you have to solve problems in physics and understand something about the way physics works. The game Digital Zoo, which I talk about in the book, is a great example of that. So this is a spring mass modeling simulation, which sounds about as exciting as, watching growing grass. But it turns out it's really cool. You can make little creatures that dance around like the creatures in a Pixar movie, say. And while you're building them, you actually have to figure out a lot about things like the center of mass and cross-bracing concepts in physics and engineering in order to make these creatures dance around. And so these games always have an opportunity to learn by trying to figure out how to do something in one of these simulated worlds.
So it is learning by doing, kind of.
Absolutely. It's learning by doing on a grand scale. And that's not a new idea. You know, John Dewey was talking about that 100 years ago. The difference is the number of things that we can now do is much larger that kids can safely do is much larger because we have computer simulations. And so it's an opportunity to take the idea of learning by doing and do it on a massive scale.
Hmm. David Williamson Schaefer, our guest today, author of How Computer Games Help Children Learn. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about how we can mine the potential of video game technologies to transform learning among our children today with David Schaefer, our guest, author of How Computer Games Help Children Learn. It's published by Palgrave, and glad to have him along. And certainly, if you want to join in with your questions or comments, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And before we go back to the phones, this whole concept of learning certainly is quite different from our traditional education, as you've mentioned, and bumps up a kind of against the No Child Left Behind programs that we have here in the United States.
Yeah, bumps up against is a very polite way of putting it, I think. Yeah. It really flies in the face of it. I mean, a way to think about No Child Left Behind, right, is it's training you to to answer questions that have one specific right answer. Well, those are the kinds of questions that either somebody else can do cheaper or even worse, that something that the computer can do for you. Why would we spend all that time? I mean, let me give you an example. So we spend essentially the first 6 to 8 years of our kids' mathematical education training them to do what a 99-cent calculator can do. Now, in a world of global competition, that's not going to get you very far. What we need to be doing is getting them to think about problems that you need computers, you need calculators, you need sophisticated technologies to solve, rather than to replicate the thing that the computer can do by itself.
Hmm. David in DeForest, your turn. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. How are you two doing?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Regarding children's computer games, I ran across a series that is really great. It makes them think and problem solve. I don't know if you're familiar with Putt-Putt and Freddy Fish, Pajama Sam, Spy Fox.
But my kids love Pajama Sam.
Oh, they are just so good. I sit down next to them and we'll go through it. They can take an hour to finish a game, and every time you play it, it's different. And it makes them really think and try to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, there are a lot of great games out there. I mean, as I said earlier, there are also games that aren't great or aren't great for kids. But there are a lot of games give kids opportunities to solve problems in interesting ways. One of the things that I emphasize in the book, though, is that the game is always more than just what comes in the box and what the kids see on the screen. The game is all the people that they talk to, all the things that they do, all the things that they think about, the websites they visit, the books they look up in order to help them play the game better, the people they call, and so forth. As adults, we have both an opportunity and a responsibility to make the games that our kids play great games. Pajama Sam is a great game. It's not one of the ones I talk about in the book, but it happens to be a great game. But what makes it a great game isn't just what comes in the box. It's also the fact that you are looking over their shoulder. You are talking with them about it. You are giving them ways of thinking about what they're doing so that they can turn play in the game into understanding about the world around them.
Yeah. How old are your kids, David?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. John in New Lisbon, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, how's it going?
Great.
I just want to say I'm a big fan of your ideas on video games. I've been an avid gamer for years. But an interesting note, too, is even some of the intense adventure games or action games that require, you know, even on like some consoles that require a lot of different Switch actualizations, that has helped me in my career. I'm an F-16 pilot, and so, you know, on the throttle and the stick, there's all kinds of stuff, and I'm a firm believer that, you know, the video gaming and the intense in certain, even those types of games can even help in certain careers.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's even some data that shows that surgeons who play monkey ball improve their dexterity as they're operating. I wasn't meaning to suggest that you can necessarily suggest any one class of games or type of games is good or bad. I think it depends a lot on the game, and as I said a moment ago, and as I say over and over in the book, and it depends on how you play it and who you play it with, and especially for kids, what role the adults around them play in helping them turn those games into opportunities for learning.
Yeah,
I agree with you 100%. Thank you. I think, I'm a big fan of your ideas. It's great.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, John. You do mention a military game in your book that really causes kids to really think hard.
Yeah, it's America's Army. It's one of the was a very well known game about a year ago and is still around. It was produced by the military as a recruiting tool, actually. When you talk with the people who produced it, it's not a recruiting tool. At least when it was designed, it wasn't a recruiting tool in the sense of just trying to convince everybody to join up, because the military isn't any more interested in having people who aren't going to fit in than any other job is. So it tries to portray what life is like as a soldier, and it's very different, therefore, than the shooter games that you see where you just, you know, run around shooting everything in sight. The military actually has very complicated rules of engagement. It's a hard job to do. The game is rated M for mature, so it's not supposed to be for kids younger than 17. But certainly, if you had a kid who was considering the military as a career, that's probably not a bad way to at least explore some of what that might be like. Again, I certainly wouldn't suggest you should just play the game and make your decision about whether to enlist based on that. It's one tool among many, and that's one of the things that I'm trying to emphasize in the book, is these are very important tools for learning. It certainly shouldn't replace everything else we do, but we shouldn't leave it out of the equation either.
Thanks again, John. Appreciate it. Joe in Milwaukee, your turn next. Hi, Joe.
Hey, good morning. Well, that was a perfect segue. Actually, that was going to be my comment, was that, you know, I'm also a pilot, actually, a commercial pilot. We use a lot of highly advanced simulations in terms of practicing. But, you know, even as advanced as those are, and even as many variables as they take into account, they can never fully model the reality that is reality. And, you know, what I worry about with a lot of the games that are being touted for educational purposes is, number one, that they're kind of being seen as a panacea, and your guests just addressed that. You know, it's one tool in your toolkit, and they're probably very good tools, but it shouldn't, in my opinion, be seen as a panacea. And the second thing, and he addressed this a couple of callers back while I was waiting on hold, was that I think it's very important for kids to interact with the real world, and that's the human real world, you know, real human interactions, and also the natural world. And that's probably the biggest thing that I worry about, is that kids are being kind of taken out of the natural world and not seeing how the natural systems work as a participant in that world. And you're never going to model that in a computer game. I mean, we're not God. We can't think of all the variables. So those are my two comments.
Joe, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. David, comment from you.
Yeah, those are great points, Joe. I mean, and especially the point about being removed from the world completely. You know, one of the things that I say in the book and that I try and emphasize over and over again whenever I talk with people about games is that balance is important. You know, it's important that kids are outside playing ball and digging with sticks in the mud and hanging out doing nothing with their friends. It's also important that they read some books and that they watch some television and that they see some movies and that they use the computer in ways that are going to get them to be literate in digital technologies, both the technology itself and in the ways of thinking that go with it. So you're absolutely right. Balance is critical. And the point that I'm making is that we are actually out of balance right now in the sense that we don't use computer technology in sophisticated ways to educate our kids, or we don't use it enough. But it certainly shouldn't replace anything. I would say, though, that it is also possible to design games that do get kids involved in the world around them. So, for example, Urban Science, the game that I described earlier, the city that kids are redesigning is their city. They actually go to State Street in if they're playing it in Madison, and they look at the street and they take pictures of the street. They're talking to people who are at least representing the real interest groups that are in Madison who care about that city. So it is possible to have games that are more closely connected with other parts of the world. And in fact, that's one of the best ways to have something that you play in the game help you understand something about the world around you. But even with the best game that did that in the best possible way, that still is not a substitute for all these other things. We need to have balance, and it's our job as adults to make sure that kids get that balance.
Joe, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. David Schaefer, our guest today, as we talk with him about his book, How Computer Games Help Children Learn. It's published by Palgrave, and glad to have him along. And certainly, if you have some questions or comments for him as we move along, give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. How far behind or how bad is our situation, do you feel, in terms of our education? Is it in crisis?
Well, you know, if it's not in crisis, I don't know whether it's in crisis now. But if we don't do something about it soon, I think it will certainly be. I mean, there was a study that I talk about in the book that came out about a year ago that suggested that something like 50% of minority students and 30% of students overall drop out at some point before they finish high school. And when they interviewed a sample of those of dropouts, 80% said they dropped out because school was boring and irrelevant to their career goals. You know, I'm not sure what your definition of crisis is, but that sounds pretty bad. And it's especially bad if what we're doing is trying to steer them into a system. It's especially bad if they're right, which is that, in fact, what we're doing in school may be irrelevant to the world that they're preparing for. So, yeah, I think we have a real problem.
You talk about – you mentioned different levels of children, poor to rich, minorities to non. And you talk a lot about there's some really interesting studies, I think you point out in your book. Pick one, Escher's World, for example, and talk about that before we go back to the phones again. And
sure. So the way the book is organized is around a series of games that we've developed. And we developed these games not necessarily to have them played across the country, although ultimately that would be great, but because we want to test how do you build a good game? What are the principles? What are the criteria and so forth? And so each of these games explores kind of a different aspect of that. In the game Escher's World, for example, one of the things we were looking at is the role that let me take a step back. I'm sorry. I got myself lost a little bit there. Mm-hmm. So the idea behind all these games is that we actually know a lot about innovation and creativity and how people become innovative and creative thinkers. And we know that because we can look around at people who solve problems in the world that don't have pat answers. People like doctors and lawyers and architects and engineers, people for whom no two problems have the same answer. There's no set formula for how you go about doing your work. And what we do in these games is study how those people learn to think about real problems in creative ways. And it turns out there's a pattern. Most of the people who do that kind of work learn to think the way they think by actually trying to solve real problems and then talking about what it is that they've done with peers and with mentors, with people who know more and with other people who are struggling with the same questions. And so what our games try and do is recreate that process. So in Escher's World, in the game, the players are designing a museum exhibit. And they're doing it by working as graphic artists. And so what they do in the game is the same kinds of things that graphic artists do when they learn to think about problems. And the way that graphic artists do that is in a design studio. Architects do the same kind of thing. And so what the game does is gives players a chance to actually design these really interesting creations using a computer simulation and then talk about them systematically with other players in the game and people who are playing the role of master graphic designers. And what we find is that not only do they learn to make good designs, they learn about the mathematics that's underneath the designs, things like symmetry and balance and so forth. And then when they go back to school, they actually are doing better in school because not only do they have some knowledge of the mathematics that they're going to be getting to in their curriculum, but they feel like they have new ways of talking to to adults. They have a sense of having done something that matters in the world, of having understood something deeply, and that tends to carry forward in terms of their sense of who they are and who they are as a student.
Yeah. And you talked about one young girl, as an example in that particular chapter.
Yeah, Natalie.
Natalie. Yeah, right. She was working
you're talking about there's a couple of different kids that I talk about in that chapter. There's an example of a girl by the name of Hallie, which was really interesting. She was really a very sort of shy and retiring kid, spoke so softly sometimes you couldn't hear what she was saying. And she got really interested in something that she called exploding negative space, which was this design effect where the design looked like it was kind of pulsating and vibrating and exploding all over. And so she spent weeks literally trying to figure out what's the best way to make these designs look exploding. And in the end, in order to do that, she had to understand some reasonably sophisticated mathematics to get her designs to work the way that she wanted to do. And so the chapter tells that story. The other kid from Escher's World that I thought you were going to ask about was Natalie, who was also interesting. I mean, here was a kid who's playing the game and seemed kind of not engaged as you might expect a kid playing a game could possibly be. Seemed more interested in flirting with the boys in class than in actually making designs. And then in the end came back a few months later when we interviewed her when she was back in school, and she was getting A's in all her classes. And she, attributed it all to this experience of playing the game and not only learning some mathematics, but really having a new way of talking about art and about math and about school, talking to adults, talking to other kids. So the effects of these games can be really profound.
And I think an interesting point that you make, at least in your research, that it didn't make any difference the kid's background really didn't make a whole lot of difference, did it?
No, so far it hasn't. Now, you know, you certainly would expect that if this was being done by hundreds and thousands and hundreds of thousands of kids across the country, that there might be some systematic differences. The only ones that we've seen so far are pretty much what you'd expect. That is, kids with higher, you know, with who write better and who are sort of doing better in school more generally tend to do better in the games because – not surprisingly, they come with more skills than other kids do. But other than that, you know, we tried it with a range of kids. We tried it with kids who really wanted to be there playing the game. We've played it with kids whose parents just made them come, and none of that seems to make a significant difference in terms of the outcomes that we see.
We'll take some more calls. Give us a call if you have a question or comment as we talk about how computer games help children learn with David Schaefer. The number to call if you're in the Madison area is 263-1890, 263-1890. Anywhere else, toll free at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Mary in Wisconsin Dells, your turn now. Good morning, Mary. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Good morning. I'm excited about having the computer used for learning, but my concern is that I was a keyboarding teacher, and so often times people think it's okay to let kids just hunt and peck for years on the computer before teaching them to use it correctly. And then it's like handing them a clarinet and then telling them 4 or 5 years later, okay, here's how you finger it. Or the same thing with golf. You don't, you know, give them a golf club and say, go play golf without showing them how to use it correctly. And so I'm concerned that parents realize that before you just let them go play all these games, you have a responsibility to teach them how to use it so that they don't have to think about where the letters are and they can just, you know, really use it quickly and efficiently and so forth. So what I've done is I've written a book called Keyboarding First so that kids from like 5 on up can learn to use it correctly, because so much of the software out there is too hard for them, or they are still look at their fingers and so forth.
Thanks for calling, Mary. Comment, David?
Yeah, Mary, you're clearly more of a keyboard expert than I. I actually do still hunt and peck or do some version of it. I'm not one to speak as to sort of what the best age to teach kids to keyboard is or not. But certainly it speaks to the larger issue, which is that parents do have a role to play in shaping the interactions that their kids have with computers. That we need to think about making sure not just that they're using them, but that they're using them in interesting ways, that they're thinking about it, that they're using it responsibly, and so forth.
Thank you, Mary, for calling. Appreciate it. Carol in Manitowoc, it's your turn next. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. I'm a curriculum director in a district other than Manitowoc. And this summer, my early childhood teachers presented to me the research suggesting that too many digital experiences on early childhood kids affect their hard wiring, and that we should be paying more attention to developmentally appropriate play and things like that versus digital opportunities. Does the doctor have any feelings on that?
Well, as I said earlier, you know, it is absolutely true that you could spend too much time using computers, just as you could spend too much time reading books, or you could spend too much time outdoors and not reading books. So finding the right balance is important. I certainly don't know of anything that suggests that having any digital experiences at all is bad for young kids. And I would find it difficult to believe that appropriate digital experiences, that could be possible. But it's certainly true that you would want to find the right balance, and that should absolutely include for young kids, playing with crayons and playing with markers and playing with dolls and dress up and all kinds of other things. And that if you, plug kids in front of a computer, it's certainly at least as bad as just plugging them in front of a television, and for many of the same reasons.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Is there an appropriate age to start children on computers?
Well, I think right away. I mean, just as we take little kids, infants, and put them on our lap and read a book to them, you could certainly, and we have them watch, you know, some people have them watch the Baby Einsteins and other little videos. You can have your kid on your lap and you can, I mean, find things that would be interesting to them. When my oldest daughter was just beginning to speak, she was really interested in walruses, and we spent a lot of time on the internet searching for pictures of walruses, which she loved. And of course, one of the things that we were doing was talking about, you know, how do you know it's a walrus? Well, because it has big teeth and so forth. And the content of it didn't matter. She's soon tired of walruses, as you might imagine. But the experience is certainly one that I think has helped prepare her to, you know, now that she's older, go and search on, but you know, on Google by herself to find things when she's interested in doing an art project.
Mm-hmm. And she's now how old?
She's 8. And so for example, we're she's making a rabbit out of paper mache at home right now. And in order to figure out what the rabbit should look like, she went and you know, searched online to find pictures of rabbits that were the kind of rabbit that she wanted to model. And that's a really important skill, and it's also an important way of showing that, you know, these things don't exist just in isolation. They blend together.
Hmm. David Schaefer, our guest, if you'd like to join in with a question or comment, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. You call the games that are games that you like epistemic.
Yeah.
Games. Go back to that again.
So, sure. So epistemology is an old word. It's an old Greek word, and it's not one that you hear much, but it's a really important one in thinking about the difference between life in an industrial society and life in a knowledge-based society in a world of global competition like we have. You know, epistemology is literally the study of knowledge. It's how we know something. And you can think about it as, how is it that we decide that something is the right thing to do? How do we justify an action? How do we prove to somebody that what we're saying is right? It turns out that different people who solve problems in the world have different epistemologies, different ways of justifying what they do, of deciding what the right thing is. So doctors and lawyers and architects and engineers all have different ways of deciding when they've got a right answer and of proving to somebody that they have a right answer. You know, a way to think about that would be if there's some question as to whether your spleen needs to be removed, a doctor thinks about whether that's the right thing to do differently than the lawyer thinks about whether that's the right thing to do. Now, if you're in the hospital about to go into the operating room, I would say go with what the doctor says. If you're in the courtroom, you want to go with what the lawyer says. But what that's doing is just emphasizing that we have different ways of deciding how it is that we know we've got a right answer. And the reason that that's important is that for a long time in schools, right, the epistemology of schools is basically there is a right answer. You have to learn what it is and spit it back on the test. Whereas when you solve problems in innovative and creative ways, different people who solve different problems need to think about those in ways that are appropriate. And so what we can do is build games that develop the epistemologies, the ways of thinking of people who solve problems in the world. And that's why I call them epistemic games.
Mm. Craig in Oshkosh, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Craig.
Hi. My question is, I enjoy board gaming. And part of the reason I really enjoy that is the social interaction. And I wondered if you had any comment related to gaming and education and using board games.
Sure. So one of the points that I make in the book is that what digital technologies do is make it possible for more people to play more different kinds of games, but many of the same principles apply. So there are great board games that can be used for educational purposes and, in fact, sometimes are. I'd also add that an important part of playing board games is the social experience. An important part of playing computer games, and especially playing them well, is also the social experience. The people that you talk to, and if you watch kids play, as often as not, they actually are playing together, not necessarily even both of them with their hands on the keyboard or on the mouse, but looking over each other's shoulder, commenting, talking about it after they've played. So the social element is very important. And once again, that highlights that what we see with these new technologies is not – are things that we've been able to do before but in a much more limited way. And now that we can do them, do more of them and have more people playing more games about more different kinds of things, the potential for changing the education system is just much bigger.
Thanks very much for calling, Craig. Appreciate it.
You bet.
David Schaefer, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller, talking computers and children here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi.
Talking with David Schaefer today about his book, How Computer Games Help Children Learn. If you'd like to join in with your own questions or comments, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And let's take another call. Jackie in Stoughton, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello, I'm Jackie. I have an interesting story, and if I hadn't seen it, I might not have believed it. I have a grandson, Nathan, and Nina, and my daughter was at the computer, and he kept pulling on her and wanting to climb up. She finally put him on her lap, and he was reaching for the keys, so that didn't work. And the next day, she went out and bought a child's game, and at that time, it was 3 years old, was the youngest. And she propped him up on two big dictionaries and said, "Now don't fall," and put that in, and I was there that day, and within 2 days, he had that mastered, and by the fourth day, he was kind of bored by it. So, you know, 16 months, to me, that's just...
amazing.
it's amazing. It really is.
Well, thanks for calling. David, a comment?
Yeah, well, you know, so when we're developing these games, we always have to sit down and figure out. We have to have a storyboard for them. So what is it that the players do? What happens next? And so forth. And one of the things that always happens is we take our best guess at what the storyboard is going to look like, and then we have to go back and we have to say, okay, now let's just assume that the kids are actually going to be able to do everything about three times as fast as we planned. because it's always striking how quickly they're able to pick some things up. And, of course, some things that they don't pick up as quickly as well. But, you know, that when you're young and you're impressionable and picking up languages and picking up new ideas at the rate that little kids are picking them up, it's hard for us adults to remember what life is like when you're that open to new experiences. And it's one of the reasons that I encourage parents and teachers and any adult really to play with kids, because you really have to see what it's like when they're actually playing, because it's not the same as if you're just playing by yourself.
Thanks again, Jackie. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Ellen in Great Lake, Illinois. Your turn now. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I just have a point that about young children 3 and under, it's fine to sit with them at the computer and show them pictures, but there's been considerable research that's been done that gets to the point that the woman 2 or 3 callers before was making about how it does affect their hardwiring if they're playing games and if they're playing things that have very rapid response. And the American Pediatrics Association has come out with vehemently saying that children under 3 should not play computer games or watch much television at all. Children under school age should play no more than an hour or two a week. And if you talk to – I talked to a lot of teachers, early childhood education teachers and kindergarten, first grade teachers, and there's a lot of research that's being done about how playing with these games and watching TV does affect the hardwiring and is could be partially responsible for the high incidence of ADD and ADHD.
Well, there's certainly no doubt, Ellen, that that everything that we do affects our hardwiring. In fact, people used to believe that our brains basically stop developing once we hit adolescence. And maybe that was just because it seems like adolescent behavior suggests that there's no way that their brains could be continuing to develop. But more recent research shows that our brains are constantly wiring and rewiring themselves to deal with the particular problems that we face in the world. So whatever it is that we do, we're conditioning ourselves to do better. And whatever it is that we don't do, we're not developing our brains in order to do that. And neurons are growing and dying all the time. So it's absolutely true that the experiences that we give kids at any age are experiences that are going to be shaping their hardwiring. That's part of how we learn. The issue, I think, is how much and of what kind I don't think anybody would suggest that simply picking a game off the shelf and sitting down with a kid of any age would be a good thing to do, just as picking a book off the shelf and showing it to a kid of any age, or picking television off the shelf and showing it to a kid of any age would be a bad thing to do. Would be a good thing to do. Sorry, I got myself backwards there. But there certainly are things that you can show kids that on video that are good experiences for young children to have. Pictures of nature, for example, mm-hmm. that they couldn't otherwise have access to. We know that books can be good things for young kids and wire their brains in particular ways. You know, the thing that's challenging for us as adults is that the world is changing very fast around us, and that the experiences that most of us had as adults we're not in quite the same world that our kids are being prepared for. And so it is absolutely challenging and frightening in some ways, but true that we have to be thinking very carefully about the experiences that we give our kids. I would never suggest that as a blanket recommendation, just pick up any game and play it with your kids. But I think being thoughtful in the way that you obviously are about what experiences you want your kids to have is important, and making sure that some set of digital experiences that you think are appropriate for your kids is an important part of their upbringing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Ellen, for calling. Appreciate it very much. And Stacy in Ironwood, Michigan, will give you a chance. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is almost exactly like the previous caller's question, so I think you kind of answered it, but we're actually looking at a Waldorf school in Wisconsin to have our child go to school at, and I know that they don't have any computers in there at all and really discourage people from, you know, having TVs even for little kids to see. I guess I wonder, are there studies backing up what you're saying, that these things are actually helping kids as opposed to, you know, having negative effects? Like, I guess it's easy to say, yeah, if you pick good software, whatever, your kid can learn how to do this compared to somebody that's not exposed to any of that. But are there actual studies that show this is a better way to learn in little kids?
Well, I think, and this is a point that I make in the book over and over again, I think the issue is that what it is that kids should be learning is a changing target right now. So what would it mean to say that there are studies that show that this is a good way to learn? It depends on what it is that you're trying to learn. So one of the things we don't do, for example, is spend a lot of time looking at whether or not the games that we develop help kids do better on standardized tests, because as I argued earlier, that's the wrong thing to be shooting for. You know, most of the studies that we've done on the games that we work on in the book are with slightly older kids. So the emphasis in my own work isn't on really young kids,
okay,
although we're moving to younger and younger kids. But the question is always, you know, what is it that means to be educated in a digital world? And what I suggest in the book is that it looks very different than what we're used to, and that it's focused much more on being able to actually solve problems in the real world in creative ways by working on real problems in creative ways.
Well, it seems like that's true, but if you try and teach a child that's really young to read and they're just, it's not appropriate for their age, you can actually frustrate them. Whereas if you wait till they're a little bit older, they learn more quickly and it's not a problem. So it seems like trying to teach little kids how to use this technology, it just seems like they're not developed. I mean, we haven't changed as far as our development goes to match this technology. You know what I mean?
I do, and you know, certainly the idea that it's really important to wait until kids show you that they're ready to read is something that I'm not an expert in the Waldorf, but I know that that's one of the principles of the Waldorf schools. Especially with very little kids, sure, if you find yourself cramming something down their throat, that's probably a bad idea, but at least from my experience with very little kids, they're pretty good at telling you what they're interested in and ready to do and what they're not. As long as you're respectful of that as well, your kids are probably in pretty good shape that mm-hmm. way.
As we look at these games and try and decide, you do spend some time, and maybe in our last minute or two here, we can talk about What should parents be doing in terms of evaluating these games?
Right. Well, so one of the things that I talk about in the book and that I think is really important is that parents educate themselves about games. My book certainly is one resource. Our website, the companion website, How Computer Games Help Children Learn.com, has some other books that are suggested. They're also in the bibliography and mentioned in my book. So, you know, it turns out that reading is one good way to learn about games. Another good way is to play them yourself. Either pick up games that you might think are interesting and play them and see what's good and not so good and how you could help your kid. One of the best ways is to play the games with your kids. If you're wondering how to get started, you could go to the game store, go to a store with them and pick out a game. Every kid wants yet one more present after the holiday, right? Mm-hmm. And sit down with them and make a commitment with them that, you know, you're going to learn to play and they're going to learn to play and they're going to be patient with you and so forth. And to actually get some experience with them yourself. And then one of the things I talk about in the book is this idea that the game is always bigger than just what comes in the box. And so thinking carefully about how you talk with your kid about the games that they play. Ask them questions about the strategies they've used, what seems good and bad, what they like and don't like, and why. And the book makes some more specific suggestions as well.
David, a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Larry.
David Schaefer is author of How Computer Games Help Children Learn, a wonderful book, and I highly recommend it to you. Take a look at it and read it. It says a lot about education of our children. I'm Larry Mueller. Coming up, a tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King here on the Ideas Network.